Hello, and welcome to this bonus episode of the Talking Heads podcast.
While our usual episodes at this time will continue with Lucy and I talking about our head gardening lives, we also thought it would be nice to bring you other voices from the horticultural world.
So, from time to time, we'll be bringing out these bonus episodes featuring conversations with head gardeners, curators, garden owners, and other horticulturists from across the UK.
Grab your favourite cuppa and settle back into this episode. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Talking Heads. And we're going to have one of our infrequent, but always brilliant, bonus episode interviews with one of our peers. Now, Lucy's here. So good evening, Lucy.
Hello, Saul.
Are you all right?
I am very well. Thank you very much. Enjoying some really lovely sun in autumn, which is actually, to me, delicious. It's one of my favourite times. I don't like things too hot. And for me, the sunshine...
You've had sun.
Yeah,
we've had awful down the West Country.
We've had
awful
rain as well. We had 25 mil today, so we've had a good old dousing. For Essex, that's, you know, that's possibly positively monsoon-like. So, yeah. But we've had some really lovely sunshine as well. It's been very, lots of rainbows, that kind of weather.
Lovely, lovely. Let's hope that continues for you. But we're also joined this evening by used to be a fellow head gardener. I'm not sure what you would term yourself now, Stephen. We'll find out as we do this interview, I'm sure. But someone who's been a head gardener for quite a long time. So it's very nice to have him on the podcast. And that's Mr. Stephen Edney. Evening, Stephen.
Hello.
Hello, Stephen. Lovely to see you.
You too.
If people don't know Stephen, check him out, because he's quite a horticulturalist. He's quite a plantsman. He sings to both mine and Lucy's hearts because he loves his plants. He's been around for quite a bit, but what we do usually on these interviews, Stephen, is ask people how they got into gardening, because there's different routes, all different types of stories, and how you became a head gardener, why you wanted to be a head gardener, and where you're going now. So let's start from the beginning. How did you get into this wonderful profession?
Do you know, I've heard a few of these sort of stories before from people who were growing plants from 4 years old, and they can remember the first thing that they sowed and the first flowers they picked, and although I had quite a green fingered set of grandparents, and we did an awful lot of veg growing, actually not really flower growing. It was all for the table. We sort of chutneyed and pickled and jammed our way through the summer with all the gluts of stuff that we had, so that was kind of an upbringing. It was all very much about food. And not really about flowers at all. But I didn't really have much of an interest, I would say, other than a personal enjoyment. I didn't think for a second it could become an occupation, something I could make a living out of, as I was sort of growing up through my teenage years. And I really, if I'm honest, when I left school, I didn't want to do anything. If I wanted to kick back on the sofa and kind of relax, I just had all those years at school, and it had nearly burst a blood vessel in my head. And I didn't enjoy academia, if you like, in the school sense. And it was my nan who said, but you love being in the garden with me and your granddad, you love growing stuff, why don't you go to a horticultural college? And I hadn't really thought about it, so they dragged me along. Many years later, actually, after starting a horticultural college. So I asked my nan why on earth she tried to push me in that direction. I grew up in a really deprived area in Margate. You know, it's pretty desperate, at the edge of a council estate, very poor area. And she said, oh, Sonny, I was just trying to keep you out of prison. I think because we all had, too many rough friends and too much energy. I had too much energy, she said. They just didn't know what to do with me.
Right.
She
put it behind a spade. Wise lady.
Yeah. Well, oh, she really was. She had a very persuasive but gentle nature, which was great, and is just what I needed, really. So I went along to an open day at my local horticultural college, which was Hadlow College, because I'm in East Kent, and there really isn't much in East Kent other than the sea, because it surrounds us on three sides. And we always used to joke that if you haven't hit the sea within 20 minutes, then you must be going to Canterbury, because it's the only landmass So you couldn't really get lost where I came from. I managed to secure an apprenticeship. And so at 16 years old, I got an apprenticeship. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get an apprenticeship actually with the college. So for 2 years of apprenticeship in horticulture, in landscape construction was my sort of options, if you like. But it was a general horticultural certificate. And it was a couple of days a week at college and 3 days actually working on the college grounds. And it was an amazing opportunity, which I didn't realize how amazing it was. And of course, like you never do when you're in it until after it's gone, to be surrounded by so many dedicated gardeners. And I was hooked. I turned up with a, you know, with a general interest of wanting to work outdoors with my hands and you know, burn some energy and do something that I could physically see at the end of each day. There was actually something, you know, tangible in front of me, and left Hadlow after 2 years with an absolutely insatiable desire to know more. So after my apprenticeship, I actually then went into full-time education at Marist Wood. I actually went to the dark side. So I studied arboriculture, left horticulture.
I noticed that. I did a bit of reading up. I was like, okay.
Do you know that there isn't a plant that doesn't interest me? At that kind of age, I had no fear. And I thought, well, I can, you know, I can make some money out of having no fear. I don't mind dangling out of a tree on a bit of rope with a chainsaw. And I absolutely love trees.
What boy wouldn't like to do that? You know, really?
I know. It was kind of living the dream. I couldn't believe somebody was actually going to pay me to climb into a tree with a chainsaw and start chopping bits off of it.
Say, I love trees. the problem with Lucy is if you can't eat it, it's not worth it, really, is it? But no.
Hang on. No, my husband's got some very, very skilled tree surgeon friends. And I honestly, anyone who can leap around the tree, as you say, with all the ropes and the harnesses and the chainsaw and do a decent job of felling a tree or thinning a crown or whatever it might be, hats off to him. So, you know, that's I was teasing you. That's a lovely route to take, Steve.
Well, you know, it didn't last too long. I still always had a calling to come back to flowering plants and herbaceous plants and to growing food. And this is obviously the reason I ended up finally, 11 years after I started horticulture, why I ended up as a head gardener, because we're often, you know, that jack of all trades. We dip in and out of all subjects and we don't tend to specialise. Some do. I obviously have specialisms, but I'm also a very good generalist as well. Well, reasonable generalist, should we say. I'll leave it up to other people whether or not they think I'm a very good generalist. and that's often how head gardeners end up where they are.
I was going to say, I agree with you fully, Stephen, because everyone asks me, I have my passions, but everyone asks me, what do I specialise in? And I say, well, really, the whole gamut of horticulture, because... Yeah, that's it. Absolutely, because I think as a head gardener, you really do have to have that skill set in almost everything that is, and not just plants, machinery. I'm good at machinery. I'm good at hard landscape, and I'm good at all the other kind of things. Because as head gardener, you have that whole picture to look at.
Oh yeah, exactly. There's no point being on the big estate if you don't know how to, like you say, tend the fruit trees and the veg garden. But also, you've got to understand the meadows and the ponds and the grass and the trees and the shrubs and the lawns, the hedges. Yeah, it is. Do you know what, though? It's a really good foundation. I think that term jack of all trades sounds a bit derogatory and I don't think it's fair. I think it's that head gardeners have a fantastic broad knowledge and it's a lovely foundation. And I think anyone under a head gardener who is lucky enough to train under one to get all those different facets, you know, to get a good base of knowledge in those areas, it's a lucky person.
Yeah, I have to say, being a head gardener was an absolute thrill. I still think of myself as a head gardener, of a diminished team. That's all, a team of me, you know.
Sometimes we're the hardest people to look after, aren't we, ourselves?
Oh, yeah, we're our own worst critics, head gardeners. There's no doubt about that.
God, that's so true. Yeah. That's what makes a good head gardener, though, Stephen, I think. You know, high standards.
Yeah, my gardeners and my students and my volunteers, they got sick to death of listening to me say, attention to detail is what makes you a professional. It separates you from all the would-be gardeners. It is about, you know, it's about dedication and passion and commitment. And, you know, it's about going the extra step in everything you do, you know, paying real attention to things. And it's not okay, or it's not just good enough. It's, have I done the right thing in the right way at the right time? Or if I am experimenting, do we understand what we're doing and why? And so it was the inquisitiveness that I hope to instill in my gardeners, and also to take away the fear of being a gardener. I'm surprised how much fear there is amongst young gardeners and new gardeners. Maybe it was just because I was so full of beans when I was young, but I don't remember being afraid. Or maybe it's just my nature. You know, people tell me I'm a bit of a show off. So maybe it's just that I always thought I was capable, even when I wasn't.
It's that confidence of youth, isn't it? It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, but it seems these days some of the youngsters are terrified of making mistakes. And I said that's a really important part of the process of learning to be a gardener.
Almost the most important thing, I think, is because that's how you learn to take the next step. Or what doesn't work actually informs you towards what does work. You know, it's almost fundamental actually to my gardening year, in that most things fail, but then when something does work, then that's great.
They're the things we talk about the most, don't we? Talk about our successes. We try and skirt around the failures, but we should talk about the failures more.
We're going to do that as our, I think that's going to be the topic of on our next podcast when we're together, Saul, aren't we? What the things, the successes and failures, and what to learn. You know, that's an opportunity to learn and take yourself forward.
Absolutely.
So nothing's a failure; it's just an experience.
Yeah, we keep we always used to keep a propagating handbook at work, and I would tell all the gardeners, no matter what you've done, even if you know perhaps you've walked past a plant, accidentally broken something off of it, and thought, okay, leave a clean cut behind, take the material down, and maybe try and root it in whatever way possible. If it's something important or something unusual. And I'd say, don't forget to put it in the handbook. Date when you did it, date how you did the cutting, what the medium was. Did you put it on bottom heat? What were the temperatures like? What time of day was it? Just make some notes. And then every week we used to always put them up. We put it up on a big A board, and then every week it would get transferred into the propagating handbook. And then we'd look back at the end of the year and try and compare notes at different techniques and ideas around propagating, because propagating particularly is full of failures before you find just what works for you.
Yeah. And like you say, if you don't write it down there and then, you months down the line, you think, wow, those cuttings did really well. But can I remember for the life of me how I took them? And of course, you never can. Like you say, it's an opportunity lost, isn't it? It's knowledge that you could have gained and you haven't done. So I like to think that, Stephen, that maybe you're a very efficient note taker. You like lists and notes and things like that.
I do. I always have. I love a list because you can tick things off. But even now, I have a little notebook. Last night, I was giving a talk, and I've got a little brown notebook that's just big enough. It's pocket size. And I wrote down a lady's email address. She brought me a mystery plant, and I said, I think it's a Gesneriad, but I've got to really have a close look at which one, because the family's quite big and I'm not really very familiar with it. It's not my strongest area. So give me your email and I can spend a bit of time looking. And so the notebook, everything goes into the notebook. When I'm at plant fairs, when I'm visiting gardens, when I'm in my own garden, your memory is never as good as you think it is. So just jot a note down. But it needs to be a notebook. Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. And so, Lucy, I know you're famed. I've seen Twitter, lots of Twitter feed where you love
it. I love a list. I love a list, Stephen. I'm just so thrilled that Stephen's just shown me his notebook and there's not a spreadsheet in sight. And I'm like, yes, fantastic.
Don't start her. Please do not start her on the list.
I'm sorry, Sol. I still love the old fashioned. I love a book and I love the old fashioned process of writing something in a notebook and being able to look back at it. Don't get me wrong. For the nursery, we always kept spreadsheets on Excel spreadsheets on the computer. And we had different pages for different plant collections and an overall plant list, species list for the garden. That was always on the computer.
He was just about to pull the plug. I saw him. His hand was reaching out.
you saved yourself. You've saved yourself there.
I know.
Stephen. Anyway, let's get back to hay gardening. And so where was your first position and how did you get there? How was that change? Yeah.
That's what I want to know, because I think the leap from Stephen's college path through to being head gardener was very short, and it was into a really strong position. And I'm fascinated to know, how did that happen?
I left Merriswood and was working as an arborist for a few years. But it was too specialist, really. And I was spending all of my spare time, all of my weekends, my evenings, gardening for myself, honing my skills, still loving everything I was doing and wanting to do it still as part of my job. So I decided to work freelance as a gardener for a little while. I thought it was the best foundation for me. Found a small gardening service, a guy that was running a kind of a one-man band gardening service, joined up with him, and we just went job to job, garden to garden. So every single day, no 2 days were the same, a different garden all the time, different sets of conditions, different requirements from different owners, different styles of gardens, different plants all the time being exposed to. So I spent a couple of years doing that. I also dipped into the charity sector, working for a gardening charity, which I working in deprived areas. So we were helping setting up gardening clubs. We had funding streams to help people like mine. So there was a local charity called the Garden Gate Project near me that was run by Mind. And it was so great to be able to find funding for them, and also to support them in their endeavours. And the most important thing, actually, in that garden was the pizza oven. That was exciting. But it's funny, you know, because we as professional gardeners, it's all this very high-end, you know, trying to make excellent horticultural decisions and create first-class gardens. When it's horticultural therapy, it's a different creature, and you're trying to take pressure off people. So having a pizza oven in a garden is a real game changer for a charity like the Garden Gate Project, because it brings everybody together. And so they could be gardening, and it's therapeutic gardening. So it's not pressurized. It's meant to be a reconnection with the earth. And I love that, because without getting too philosophical, I'm a softie at heart. And I'm also very passionate about my connection with nature, and it's a spiritual connection. It really is, and I can't define it, I can't really explain it, but it absolutely feels right. You know, it's not the land that we own and the land that we garden doesn't really belong to us. It's us that belongs to it.
No, I completely agree with that. So from the horticultural charity, then you went 2 feet into management, I guess.
Well, because it's that enforced management when you become a self-employed gardener. So you're suddenly, you are, you know, chief cook, clean, bottle wash, the whole lot, everything's on you. And so I became a self-employed gardener for a couple of years. And that's actually how I ended up arriving at a place called The Salutation, which is a Lutyens house and gardens. A couple called Steph and Don Parker had recently bought the property. And they, at the time, because this is late 2003, they contacted me. It was 118247, because not many people were using, you know, they got my number. Yeah. I think the old advert, you know, got your number. And so I was advertising with that. They contacted me and they wanted somebody to come in and just make a bit of sense of the place, because it hadn't really been touched in, it's about 27 years. Nobody had gardened there seriously. And the property had been left in a terrible state of repair, both the house and the 3 cottages within the grounds. There's 4 acres of gardens. The hedges hadn't been cut in 20 years. Wow. At least. It really was quite incredibly oppressive and overgrown. But even through all of that, I instantly could see the garden had been something special at some point in the past. And as soon as I realized it was a Lutyens house and a Lutyens garden, then they couldn't get rid of me, really. I just kept pestering them because they had no interest in gardening whatsoever. And they interviewed a couple of other gardeners for the position of head gardener. And a few years later, once I'd got to know them better, I asked them why they picked me. And they said, well, from our perspective, you were all very similarly qualified, although they did say one of them was probably better qualified than me, or had more experience than I had and had been a head gardener somewhere else. But they said, we liked you and we were going to be working with you day in, day out. You were going to be in our home with our young family, children around. And it was really important for us that that personal dynamic worked as well as the professional one, because it was our home. And they made me feel like part of the family.
To have that opportunity to peel back the layers of those decades of overgrowth in the garden like that must have been just a wonderful thing.
It was magic. It was bringing a garden back to life. And so few gardeners really get to experience that. We actually opened the garden to the public in year two of a 5-year restoration plan. And I took quite a lot of flack, actually, the year we opened, because people thought the garden wasn't really ready to be opened. And they were right, really. But I wanted to show them what I could see and what I had been seeing over the previous 2 years of being head gardener, and all of the changes, really the changes that we made in the first couple of years were structural changes to make the garden safe for people to come in, because it really was that, you know, in that bad a state of repair. And I wanted to share with people the whole process of a garden being reborn. But a lot of people didn't get it, and I came in for quite a bit of flack in the early days. So you had to have broad shoulders, and the family were a little nervous. And of course, because they're not gardeners, they didn't always understand all of these things. When there'd be a letter of complaint that the garden wasn't looking great, they'd panic and instantly want to remedy the problems from the letter. And I would have to calm them down and say, well, listen, remember, you know, there'd been 3,000 people through the gate before this person, and all of them seemed to be either satisfied or at least indifferent.
Not compelled to write a letter.
Yes, they didn't write a letter. I said, it's important that what we do comes out of us. And some people will like what you do and some people won't. It's a very fickle and dangerous game. If you go down the route of trying to please the public, it's better to please ourselves and then let people fall where they want. You'll have your lovers and your haters.
Oh, brilliant ethos. That's such a good mindset to have from the point of view that you had a lot of work ahead of you and you had this relationship with the family to build and gain their trust and to maintain. And actually just to, I'm soothed by those words. So I bet they were, you know.
It was a real, it was something that really bonded us, actually, was that we had to trust each other because otherwise it wasn't going to work. And so there was a huge amount of faith put in me putting in them because I'd given up my business and started a renovation at a garden. I'd taken a 50% pay nosedive to come to Salutation to begin the restoration there. We'd set down this 5-year plan of restoration and we had to have a lot of trust in each other. And so there was a lot of hand-holding at my end because they weren't gardeners. When we did something like we'd cut yew hedges right back to their bones. And you know, anybody that has seen that happen in a garden knows how terrifying that can look to a non-gardener. There were definitely moments when, you know, that I could see Steph's face was utter panic. Have we made the right decision? Is this the right head gardener for us? does he really know what he's doing, or does he just talk a good talk?
I was going to say, it's really interesting, that process. Obviously, there's the process in renovating the garden. There's the personal process of being with the family. I wonder for you, because it's your first bite of the cherry at being a head gardener, was there a process from the start and then through time where you as a person changed your style of gardening, or the way you manage your garden, or the way you practice? Was there an evolution in that?
Absolutely. In fact, it's an evolution, I think, that won't ever stop. The more I learn, the more that feeds into the decisions I make. And also the more aware we all become about the natural world and about the problems facing the planet. I've always been a very keen organic gardener, although I wouldn't say I've always gardened organically, because I haven't. But when I first arrived at Salutation, I said to the family, look, this might be a harder approach to take, but we're quite high to a water table. We are a stone's throw from the River Stour that empties out into the mouth of the sea. We need to be very careful how we approach gardening on this site. It's quite sensitive. And luckily, they were really supportive of that. I wouldn't have called us organic gardeners at the time, but that right. process got better and better with the more knowledge we gained, and the different ideas that were brought by different gardeners who came to join me. So for me, there was no ego involved. As a head gardener, yes, ultimately the decision stopped with me, but then also so did when there was any trouble to take. It was me who bore the brunt of it. But I was always very keen to surround myself with other gardeners that I could learn from and that could offer something to the garden. And it was always a collaboration. I just happened to be the kind of top of that collaborative pile. But it's very important. I always listen to what my gardeners have to say.
How far into the process did the garden start to look something like what in your mind was revealing their potential and looking really solid, and you're like, yeah, I'm happy with what's going on here. I feel reassured. The family are reassured. Whoa. When did that happen?
God, that's a great question. And, you know, I would probably say it was year three, because a lot of plants, of course, take time. They get planted, and most are successful. Some are not so successful. But most plants, particularly perennials, it's 3 years to their maximum flowering potential. I would say that's when the family started to really pay attention to the garden. They started to enjoy it, and they started to get involved in the garden. They weren't gardeners, but they used it as an entertainment space. They used it as a space to have barbecues, to have just family events. People were coming to see them and staying with them so they could spend time in the garden. And that was sort of year three. But I would actually say that it was really about 8 years before I felt really satisfied with where I was.
I know how you feel. I think for the owners, yeah. And I don't know if you're the same, Lucy, my owners felt quite comfortable within 1 or 2 years of the restoration of my place. I still don't feel comfortable. But, you know, there's still so much I want to do, or I want to get out of it personally. I still don't feel like I'm there. It's a weird perception. And I really think that's only a head gardener thing, or the person who's just managing that space, is you're always looking at it critically in some ways. And therefore, you're never really saying, oh, yeah, the garden's looking where I want it to be. There's always a bit more, isn't there?
And gardens change all the time. You know, we've lost a massive big horse chestnut tree that was a big focal point of one of the areas of the garden. It's just, it fell down last year. Massive big hole where it was. And we're like, oh, hang on, that area doesn't look anywhere near as special as it did. So, you know, it's not just us but gaining our confidence and gaining rapport with the family and understanding and trust. The gardens are shifting continually. But you know, I think we all enjoy that. We always sound like people that love that challenge and like to, as Saul and I, we've said before, we don't want to stagnate. We want to move forward and we want to learn and experiment. And that's what gardening's for, isn't it? So we're very lucky.
Yeah. And sometimes that's forced on you, you know, so some things that are are tragedies, and from the tragedy you see the new opportunity. And you know, so for us, we in 2013, so I'd been there 8 years, I was just starting to feel really comfortable where we were at, and the whole lower third of the garden was flooded, and we lost, and it was saltwater flooding as well. Oh, right. And we were
some
under
damaging stuff.
Oh, we lost 15,000 plants, roughly. We lost hedges, we lost trees, and we lost a couple of original plantings from 1912, from original Lutyens plantings. And it was devastating.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But at the same time, about 3 years later, I was sitting up on the main terrace having a cup of tea with a well-known garden writer who said, "Steve, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but actually that flood did you a favor because you have reinvented this whole lower part of the garden in a way that because you were honing your skills when you first developed it in that garden, and now you've reinvented it in a way with a whole new set of skills and a whole new eye for the garden, and it's never looked better than it does now."
Brilliant.
Wow. And that's a really nice thing to hear. And there are a few moments for me in the garden when I just wish, you know, sort of 7 o'clock on a July evening, the light was really good because it's wonderful light in East Kent, down by the coast. And it was filtering through the garden. And it was perfect. And I thought, wow, I wish there was 20,000 people right now to see what I could see. Because it's amazing.
Oh,
and
that's, I, what a lovely moment.
Love with it.
That won't ever leave you, will that, that moment?
Do you know, that's the classic, "I wish you were here yesterday," comment that I must use for every single tour I ever give of Stonelands. Yeah. "Wish you were here yesterday." So you were at Salutation for quite a long time, but obviously things moved on and you had to leave and then move on to a garden you haven't been to, well, only over the last year, really. Do you want to explain the transition from the Salutation to Canterbury Cathedral and then how that sort of worked for you?
Unfortunately, the Salutation had transitioned from a home into a hotel as the years had gone by. And a hotel group were leasing the Salutation from the owners. And unfortunately, they went bankrupt. And so very, very suddenly, the entire garden team, all of the staff, all of the waiters, waitresses, everyone, all the house staff, we were all made redundant. And it was just before, that was January 2019. It was the 2nd of January. We were still on our Christmas break, the gardeners, when I had to call them all together and say, "I'm really sorry, guys. This is it."
Yeah.
And we were really hopeful that the other owners, the actual owners, Dom and Steph, might have come in to rescue things a bit. Unfortunately, they couldn't or didn't want to. But so the property is up for sale. And I had to rethink where I was going with my horticultural career. If I'm honest, I would still be at Salutation now. I was completely in love with the garden and it has a very special place in my heart. I think a head gardener should be in love with his garden. And so for me, it was devastating. But it also then, I had the pandemic. I had the pandemic. For me, it was obviously like everybody else. It was very personal. It affected us all in different ways, but I had no job and we were in a global pandemic. And a couple of different things came out of that. And one of them was an opportunity to take on a management role at Canterbury Cathedral part-time. So I arrived and joined the team at Canterbury Cathedral for a whole year. I just loved getting underneath the skin of this very ancient space. It's wonderful, full of ancient ruins, layers and layers of history, and a really nice garden team. And it just was really helping them settle things down and work their way through the pandemic and a big restructuring that happened at Canterbury Cathedral, which was happening anyway.
Yeah.
And so horticultural services needed to be completely changed. And I helped them achieve that.
A year on, you're now moving on to your next. Probably this is where a bit of jealousy. You're going to see a lot of jealousy coming from me now, because the next stage, and actually it was happening while you were at Canterbury, and I guess it was happening after that salutation episode leaving, you had these thoughts. And I know your partner Lou is very much involved in this too, because she is also a gardener. But you now have your own space. I'm very jealous. We were at the pub at Chelsea, and I was incredibly jealous talking to Lou about this. Yeah.
No. So don't be jealous. Be aspired. That's what you need to be. That's the word.
I know. Inspired. I'm going to be inspired once I can find your acre or two of my own land. But just explain what's going on. Just explain where you're going now.
So on my 40th birthday, me and Lou were talking about, so I'm 44 now. So on my 40th birthday, I said to Lou, if we don't start looking for a piece of land now, there was never actually the intention of creating necessarily a nursery on the site, but just a garden. We said, if we don't create a space for us to retire into, now, because we're gardeners, so naturally it wouldn't be, well, where are we going to go and live, or somewhere else in the world, or are we going to go traveling? No, we're going to root ourselves in one place, and that is where we're going to see out our days. I said, if we don't start looking now, we'll be too old by the time we've sort of set the bones of a garden in to really enjoy it. So I said, we've got to start looking. So very quietly, we found a piece of land and we started building a garden. We started with a 3-acre field, nothing in it really, other than brambles, a couple, there were hedges around the edge of the boundary, and but nothing. It was completely blank canvas. And we've planted orchards, we've planted nut walks, we've planted a lawn border, which is 100 meters long and 6 meters deep. We planted nearly a 1-acre jungle garden.
1 acre jungle garden. Oh my goodness.
Oh no.
Oh, yeah. I feel your pain now. Oh dear. Wow. Oh, you lucky things. Well done.
In my bonkers mind, at the moment, in the very heart of the jungle garden is a rectangular lawn, which we've seeded. In the future, what I'd like it to be, I'd like to dig out that lawn and I'd like it to be a beach, so that you can be right in the middle of what feels like a tropical jungle paradise, as if you're going to come out off the edge of some tropical island straight onto the sea. I've got more ideas.
You need to throw coconuts into it every now and then. Have a coconut launcher from the side, and you just have that thud every hour on the hour. That could be your clock. There you go.
Thank you, Lucy. I love that idea. But I have so many wacky ideas. Lou has to keep me in check sometimes. Sometimes, of course, because she's also a mad keen gardener, we just egg each other on, which can be terrible. And that's why we ended up with a lawn border 100 metres long.
I was going to say, is that the reason why you've planted thousands and thousands of plants in this huge border?
It's a nice round number. It's a good number.
We call it the lockdown lawn border because we planted it last, well, out of a job, couldn't work because we were in the pandemic. So we just went to the land and we just escalated our plans. We fast forwarded them by years. And we planted about 4,500 perennials on this lawn border in one spring alone. And it's in its second year now, and I can't believe how well it's settling in already.
Well, I'll tell you what, I saw a video of it. So Alexandra Campbell, who's got a YouTube channel, it's called My Middle-Sized Garden. There's a lovely sort of 15, 16-minute video on the border. And that was filmed not too long ago, wasn't it?
No, just about a month ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and if anyone wants to see Stephen and Lou's 100 metre, 6 metre deep border in its full late summer colour, oh my goodness, it is looking splendid. And that was planted last year?
Last April, yeah. So not even 2 years old yet.
You know, if that doesn't whet your whistle for getting out there in the garden in this autumn and getting some plants in the ground, I don't know what we'll do. I really don't.
Is the ultimate aim for the border your experimental zone? Is it something, or you're obviously using your experience and your design knowledge and the plants that you love, and you're experimenting. Is that what the border is about?
Yeah, it's that need to satisfy our creative urges in terms of plantsmanship. And for us, plant-driven design for us is, it occupies our minds all of the time. When me and Lou were first together, she thought I was completely nuts because I keep a notebook under the bed because I don't sleep an awful lot and I wake up in the middle of the night quite often. So she found me scribbling away because I'd woken up with a plant combination idea. And I keep, so that I didn't forget it, I keep a notebook, a plant notebook under the bed. And she knew then that she's like, oh, this is literally the guy for me. You know, this is.
It was either that or that she was out the door. You know, thinking, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're far from the truth there, Sol. It was, you know, I realized a long time ago that I needed to be with a gardener or by myself because it occupies all of my time. Yeah. My, you know, oh, it's an obsession, but the most wonderful thing. I just love every minute of it. And I wish I had 7 lifetimes to live over so that I could see through all of the ideas that I have.
But can I just quickly ask, has Lou made you a better gardener? Because you've had that someone to bounce ideas off and you know, steer things a little bit. What do you think?
Do you know, that's it's nice that you get to ask these questions because people don't often think about this, but, you know, you think about famous collaborations with people. It always makes people a better gardener, I think, when they collaborate with somebody, because you have somebody to bounce ideas off of, even if they are wacky or a bit out there. Often what happens is you go a little bit nuts and then you rein each other in and you settle on something that is then really good. And she challenges me and we bicker incessantly with each other over our plant choices and ideas and color combinations. Also how we describe colors. I think obviously as a man, we tend not to see colors quite in the same way as women do. It would seem, talking to Lou, because I'm always wrong.
You've learned that lesson early on, Steve. That is the secret to a successful relationship. I'd just like to point that out. Well done.
I'm a slow learner, so I keep beating my head against that one. But it's great to have a gardening companion in that way. You're right. She absolutely has made me a better gardener because she makes me justify everything I'm doing. Yeah. And she makes me think about everything all the time. And I do the same with her. We challenge each other continuously. And sometimes that challenge is a supportive kind of challenge. Come on, I know you can do this. Just run with it. And sometimes it's a, well, are you sure? Because, you know, we both know how this ended last time, you know, so it can go either way. But also we spur each other on, you know, in the middle of winter when things are really tough. But you know, you need to be productive in order for the garden to look good the following year. To have each other is a really nice thing because you can spur each other on.
Yeah. My husband's a gardener and obviously I am too. And when we renovated our much smaller plot, there were loads of hazel stumps that needed digging out. They'd all self-sown and been left for decades, and it was a big, big job. And I just kept saying to Ian, I said, Ian, it's just digging. We're going to win. And every weekend, we'd chip away at it and chip away and pull each other through. I totally get what you're saying about that. Like I say, we do bicker about stuff as well, but in those moments where you're digging, sorry, excuse the pun, but digging deep and really having to, you know, crack on with these jogs that are a slog, when there's two of you doing it and you've got the same mindset and you're a team, it's such a lovely feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, because it really is. Like you've got it absolutely right. It's the right word. It's a slog sometimes. You've got to slog it out. That's the dedication bit of being a gardener, because if you can't dig deep and find all those extra reserves to get through those painful bits, you'll never end up with the magic.
Mm. That's what biscuits are for. Tea and biscuits on days like that.
Yeah.
Now, it's sort of morphed slightly into a nursery. And I'm quite interested because, firstly, by the name, we'll discuss that in a second. But secondly, because you did just mention that the nursery wasn't really what you were thinking about doing with the land. But I'm guessing now with your, now you're not at Canterbury and you'll think about where you're going. Has the nursery become a bit more important, or is that still a sideline kind of thing?
The nursery, growing plants has always been important. And sometimes that was just to grow plants for to raise money for charity. Sometimes it was just to feed the garden with lots of special plants that just aren't really available or that we can't afford to buy. So we became, you know, almost default nursery folk because we couldn't afford to plant 4,500 perennials that we'd just gone to a garden centre and bought. Also, the range of plants. We were looking for plants that would excel within the climatic conditions and within the soil type that we had. And so we honed in very specifically on certain genus and certain species and certain cultivars to test them out and put them through their paces and experiment with. And so I guess our experiences as gardeners have led us to be nurserymen, because you can't know every plant, but you should know what you grow. And all too often you go to a garden center these days and they're plant factories. So plants are grown somewhere else. They arrive at a garden center. The people looking after the plants at the garden center have never really grown them, and they don't know what they are sometimes. And that's a real shame. And so as a nurseryman, me and Lou, we pride ourselves on the fact that all of the plants in our nursery, we grow them. And we grow them at our land, and we know how they work. We know what they need, and certainly within our frame of experience. And we're always careful to point that out to people that we have, this is our sunshine hours. This is our average rainfall. This is our soil conditions. And this is how they work for us in that environment. Because that's why gardeners can never agree with each other, because everybody's environment is slightly different. There are generalizations, but there are also small differences amongst every garden. And so we start. So growing plants was always very important. And now creating a nursery, I want it to be a 50-50 split between being a nurseryman and being a gardener. So I'm working on private gardens and doing garden consultancy, where I go in and help garden owners and other head gardeners, just a fresh set of eyes, a friendly conversation. Have you thought about this? Had you thought about this? What's the process for that? And also actual proper hands-on gardening. But the garden at the land, because we call it the land, we haven't named it, or its name is the land. How nondescript. But we wanted it to be that way because the land we own has gone through lots of different guises over the years. We know that it was blackcurrants 50 years ago. And then we know it went into a downhill state of, you know, disrepair and was all brambles and fallow for a long time before we've taken it on. And now it has another guise where it's our mother bed, if you like. It's our mother ground for all of our stock plants. So the Long Border is wonderfully creative and a lot of experimenting going on there and lots of fun. But all of the plants across the garden can all feed into the nursery from the garden itself.
And we should say the nursery is called the No Name Nursery. And as we've found out from calling it the land, maybe marketing isn't your best skill, Stephen. Maybe that's... although No Name Nursery is probably genius.
In my opinion. Well, do you know, it has a local link. So the medieval town of Sandwich that we're right next to has the No Name Street and No Name Shop. So we've created a link to the medieval town. But also, me and Lou could never agree on what the nursery should be called. And how do you name a nursery when the mix is so eclectic? We have four national collections of plants. We have herbaceous plants. There are trees, there are shrubs, there are exotics, there are tender plants. Unlike a lot of nurseries where they often specialize, we're gardening magpies. We dip in and out of all sorts of things. And then if we love them, we offer them to other people to love as well.
That was great. You know, I think we've learned a hell of an amount there, Stephen. And I think the good thing about your story is it's going to continue on for a few more decades. So I think we're going to have to delve in and out of the story and see how it progresses.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can people see the nursery or the gardens yet, Stephen? Or is it too early? Just to quickly ask that.
We're going to be doing more videos from the land. And... it's a little too early. So next year we will be having open days at our home at Sweetbriar for National Garden Scheme. We will be doing, the nursery will be open by appointment for people, but I think it will be 2023. And then we'll think about having open days. We want to hold workshops from the land. Again, it's about sharing that knowledge. One of the things that that I'll always take away from Salutation is the fact that we were never without students, and they created such a buzz around the garden. It was so exciting to have that young energy, even older energy, but it was fresh energy. It was new energy. And so I'd always like to think we'd be able to have students and have workshops at the land in the same way we did at Salutation. So we've cherry picked all the best ideas from where we've worked before, and we're morphing them into the thing that then works for us, so that we get that really nice work-life balance.
What a brilliant thing to do.
Well, I know you're going to see a lot of me, because I'm living very vicariously through you and Lou at the moment, because it's exactly what I want to do. But oh well, you know, I'll live the dream through someone else. Anyway, thanks so much, Stephen, for coming on the episode and being such a... You can feel the energy as you talk about planting. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you live and breathe it. And I know we've only literally just met at Chelsea for the first time in person, and we've known each other for a bit now. But every time I see stuff involving you, the energy just floods through your pores to do with horticulture, and you're really inspiring in that way. So, you know, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I look forward to seeing you and Lou again soon. And hopefully we'll catch up, I don't know, in 2022, 23 on the podcast again and see how the nursery's going. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Sol. Thanks, Lucy. Joe, it's a real thrill to come on and chat with you guys. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, you have a lovely evening.
Thanks.
We really hope you've enjoyed listening into our conversation. We definitely look forward to bringing you more of these in the future.
Staying in touch with our fellow peers in the industry is more important now than ever. So if you have an idea of someone who would like to appear on the Talking Heads podcast, or indeed if you'd like to come and chat with us yourself, please do get in touch.
In the meantime, please listen to our past podcasts and enjoy a little peek into our gardening lives.
Until the next episode of Talking Heads, goodbye!